fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app.
Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 19 of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alan Chant. The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished novel by Charles Dickens. Chapter 19. Shadow on the Sundial. Again Miss Twinkleton has delivered her valedictory address, with the accompaniments of white wine and pound cake, and again the young ladies have departed to their several homes. Helena Landless has left the nun's house to attend her brother's fortunes, and pretty Rosa is alone. Cloisterham is so bright and sunny in these summer days that the cathedral and the monastery ruin show as if their strong walls were transparent. A soft glow seems to shine from within them rather than upon them from without. Such is their mellowness as they look forth on the hot cornfields and the smoking roads that distantly wind among them. The Cloisterham gardens blush with ripening fruit. Time was when travel-stained pilgrims rode in clattering parties through the city's welcome shades. Time is when wayfarers, leading a gypsy life between haymaking time and harvest, and looking as if they were just made of the dust of the earth, so very dusty are they, lounge about on cool doorsteps, trying to mend their unmendable shoes, or giving them to the city kennels as a hopeless job, and seeking others in the bundles that they carry, along with their yet unused sickles swathed in bands of straw. At all the more public pumps there is much cooling of bare feet, together with much bubbling and gurgling of drinking with hand to spout on the part of these Bedouins. The Cloisterham police, meanwhile, looking askant from their beats with suspicion and manifest impatience that the intruders should depart from within the civic bounds and once more fry themselves on the simmering high roads. On the afternoon of such a day, when the last cathedral service is done, and when that side of the high street on which the nun's house stands is in grateful shade, save where its quaint old garden opens to the west between the boughs of trees, a servant informs Rosa, to her terror, that Mr. Jasper desires to see her. If he had chosen his time for finding her at a disadvantage, he could have done no better. Perhaps he has chosen it. Helena Landless is gone. Mrs. Tisher is absent on leave. Miss Twinkleton, in her amateur state of existence, has contributed herself and a veal pie to a picnic.
"Oh, why did you say I was at home?" cried Rosa helplessly.
The maid replies that Mr. Jasper never asked the question, that he said he knew she was at home, and begged she might be told that he asked to see her.
"What shall I do? What shall I do?"
thinks Rosa, clasping her hands. Possessed by a kind of desperation, she adds in the next breath that she will come to Mr. Jasper in the garden. She shudders at the thought of being shut up with him in the house, but many of its windows command the garden, and she can be seen as well as heard there, and can shriek in the free air and run away. Such is the wild idea that flutters through her mind. She has never seen him since the fatal night, except when she was questioned before the mayor, and then he was present in gloomy watchfulness, as representing his lost nephew, and burning to avenge him. She hangs her garden hat on her arm and goes out. The moment she sees him from the porch, leaning on the sundial, the old horrible feeling of being compelled by him asserts its hold upon her. She feels that she would, even then, go back, but that he draws her feet towards him. She cannot resist, and sits down with her head bent on the garden seat beside the sundial. She cannot look up at him for abhorrence, but she has perceived that he is dressed in deep mourning. So is she. It was not so at first, but the loss has long been given up and mourned for as dead. He would begin by touching her hand. She feels the intention and draws her hand back. His eyes are then fixed upon her, she knows, though her own see nothing but the grass. "I have been waiting," he begins, "for some time to be summoned back to my duty near you." After several times forming her lips, which she knows he is closely watching, into the shape of some other hesitating reply, and then into none, she answers, "Duty, sir?" "The duty of teaching you, serving you as your faithful music-master."
"I have left off that study."
"Not left off, I think. Discontinued. I was told by your guardian that you discontinued it under the shock that we have all felt so acutely. When will you resume?"
"Never, sir."
"Never? You could have done no more if you had loved my dear boy."
"I did love him,"
cried Rosa, with a flash of anger. "Yes, but not quite in the right way, shall I say. Not in the intended and expected way. Much as my dear boy was unhappily too self-conscious and self-satisfied, I draw no parallel between him and you in that respect. To love as he should have loved, or as any one in his place would have loved, must have loved." She sits in the same still attitude, but shrinking a little more. "Then, to be told that you discontinued your study with me was to be politely told that you abandoned it altogether," he suggested.
"Yes," says Rosa with sudden spirit. "The politeness was my guardian's, not mine. I told him that I was resolved to leave off, and that I was determined to stand by my resolution."
"And you still are?"
"I still am, sir, and I beg not to be questioned any more about it. At all events, I will not answer any more. I have that in my power."
She is so conscious of his looking at her with a gloating admiration of the touch of anger on her, and the fire and animation it brings with it, that even as her spirit rises, it falls again, and she struggles with a sense of shame, affront, and fear, much as she did that night at the piano. "I will not question you any more, since you object to it so much. I will confess—"
"I do not wish to hear you, sir,"
cries Rosa, rising. This time he does touch her with his outstretched hand. In shrinking from it, she shrinks into her seat again. "We must sometimes act in opposition to our wishes," he tells her in a low voice. "You must do so now, or do more harm to others than you can ever set right."
"What harm?"
"Presently, presently. You question me, you see, and surely that's not fair when you forbid me to question you. Nevertheless, I will answer the question presently. Dearest Rosa, charming Rosa." She starts up again. This time he does not touch her, but his face looks so wicked and menacing as he stands leaning against the sundial, setting, as it were, his black mark upon the very face of day, that her flight is arrested by horror as she looks at him. "I do not forget how many windows command a view of us," he says, glancing towards them. "I will not touch you again. I will come no nearer to you than I am. Sit down, and there will be no mighty wonder in your music-master's leaning idly against a pedestal and speaking with you, remembering all that has happened, and our shares in it. Sit down, my beloved." she would have gone once more, was all but gone, and once more his face, darkly threatening what would follow if she went, has stopped her. Looking at him with the expression of the instant frozen on her face, she sits down on the seat again. "Rosa, even when my dear boy was affianced to you, I loved you madly. Even when I thought his happiness in having you for his wife was certain, I loved you madly. Even when I strove to make him more ardently devoted to you, I loved you madly. Even when he gave me the picture of your lovely face, so carelessly traduced by him, which I feigned to hang always in my sight for his sake, but worshipped in torment for years, I loved you madly. In the distasteful work of the day, in the wakeful misery of the night, girded by sordid realities or wandering through paradises and hells of visions into which I rushed, carrying your image in my arms, I loved you madly." If anything could make his words more hideous to her than they are in themselves, it would be the contrast between the violence of his look and delivery and the composure of his assumed attitude. "I endured it all in silence, so long as you were his, or so long as I supposed you to be his. I hid my secret loyally, did I not?" This lie so gross, while the mere words in which it is told are so true, is more than Rosa can endure. She answers with kindling indignation,
"You were as false throughout, sir, as you are now. You were false to him, daily and hourly. You know that you made my life unhappy by your pursuit of me. You know that you made me afraid to open his generous eyes, and that you forced me, for his own trusting good sake, to keep the truth from him, that you were a bad, bad man."
His preservation of his easy attitude, rendering his working features and his convulsive hands absolutely diabolical, he returns with a fierce extreme of admiration.
"How beautiful you are! You are more beautiful in anger than in repose. I don't ask you for your love. Give me yourself and your hatred. Give me yourself and that pretty rage. Give me yourself and that enchanting scorn. It will be enough for me."
Impatient tears rise to the eyes of the trembling little beauty, and her face flames, but as she again rises to leave him in indignation and seek protection within the house, he stretches out his hand towards the porch as though he invited her to enter it.
"I told you, you rare charmer, you sweet witch, that you must stay and hear me, or do more harm than can ever be undone. You asked me what harm. Stay, and I will tell you. Go, and I will do it."
Again Rosa quails before his threatening face, though innocent of its meaning, and she remains. Her panting breathing comes and goes as if it would choke her, but with a repressive hand upon her bosom she remains.
"I have made my confession that my love is mad. It is so mad that had the ties between me and my dear lost boy been one silken thread less strong, I might have swept him even from your side when you favoured him."
A film comes over the eyes she raises for an instant, as though he had turned her faint.
"Even him," he repeats. "Yes, even him. Rosa, you see me and you hear me. Judge for yourself whether any other admirer shall love you and live, whose life is in my hand."
"What do you mean, sir?"
"I mean to show you how mad my love is. It was hawked through the late inquiries by Mr. Crisparkle. That young Landless had confessed to him that he was a rival of my lost boy. That is an inexpiable offence in my eyes.
The same Mr. Crisparkle knows under my hand that I have devoted myself to the murderer's discovery and destruction, be he whom he might, and that I determined to discuss the mystery with no one until I should hold the clue in which to entangle the murderer as in a net. I have slowly worked patiently to wind and wind it round him, and it is slowly winding as I speak.
Your belief, if you believe in the criminality of Mr. Landless, is not Mr. Crisparkle's belief, and he is a good man, Rosa retorts.
My belief is my own, and I reserve it, worshipped of my soul. Circumstances may accumulate so strongly, even against an innocent man, that directed, sharpened, and pointed, they may slay him. One wanting link discovered by perseverance against a guilty man proves his guilt, however slight its evidence before, and he dies. Young Landless stands in deadly peril either way.
If you really suppose, Rosa pleads with him, turning paler, that I favour Mr. Landless, or that Mr. Landless has ever in any way addressed himself to me, you are wrong.
He puts that from him with a slighting action of his hand and a curled lip. I was going to show you how madly I love you. More madly now than ever, for I am willing to renounce the second object that has arisen in my life, to divide it with you, and henceforth to have no object in existence but you only. Miss Landless has become your bosom friend. You care for her peace of mind?
I love her dearly.
You care for her good name?
I have said, sir, I love her dearly.
I am unconsciously, he observes with a smile as he folds his hands upon the sundial and leans his chin upon them, so that his talk would seem from the windows, faces occasionally come and go there, to be of the airiest and playfulest. I am unconsciously giving offence by questioning again. I will simply make statements, therefore, and not put questions. You do care for your bosom friend's good name, and you do care for her peace of mind. Then remove the shadow of the gallows from her, dear one.
You dare propose to me to—
Darling, I dare propose to you. Stop there. If it be bad to idolize you, I am the worst of men. If it be good, I am the best. My love for you is above all other love, and my truth to you is above all other truth. Let me have hope and favour, for I am a forsworn man for your sake. Rosa puts her hands to her temples, and pushing back her hair, looks wildly and abhorrently at him, as though she were trying to piece together what it is his deep purpose to present to her only in fragments. Reckon up nothing at this moment, angel, but the sacrifices that I lay at those dear feet, which I could fall down among the vilest ashes and kiss, and put upon my head as a poor savage might. There is my fidelity to my dear boy after death. Tread upon it. With an action of his hands, as though he cast down something precious. There is the inexpiable offence against my adoration of you. Spurn it. With a similar action. There are my labours in the cause of a just vengeance for 6 toiling months. Crush them. With another repetition of the action. There is my past and my present wasted life. There is the desolation of my heart and my soul. There is my peace, there is my despair. Stamp them into the dust, so that you take me, were it even mortally hating me. The frightful vehemence of the man, now reaching its full height, so additionally terrifies her as to break the spell that has held her to the spot. She swiftly moves towards the porch, but in an instant he is at her side and speaking in her ear.
"Rosa, I am self-repressed again. I am walking calmly beside you to the house. I shall wait for some encouragement and hope. I shall not strike too soon. Give me a sign that you attend to me."
She slightly and constrainedly moves her hand.
"Not a word of this to anyone, or it will bring down the blow as certainly as night follows day. Another sign that you attend to me."
She moves her hand once more.
"I love you, love you, love you. If you were to cast me off now, but you will not, you would never be rid of me. No one should come between us. I would pursue you to the death."
The handmaid coming out to open the gate for him, he quietly pulls off his hat as a parting salute, and goes away with no greater show of agitation than is visible in the effigy of Mr. Sapsea's father opposite. Rosa faints in going upstairs, and is carefully carried to her room and laid down on her bed. A thunderstorm is coming on, the maids say, and the hot and stifling air has overset the pretty dear. No wonder. They have felt their own knees all of a tremble all day long. End of chapter 19. Read by Alan Chant of Tunbridge in Kent, England, during the summer of 2008. Chapter 20 of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alan Chant. The Mystery of Edwin Drood, the unfinished novel by Charles Dickens. Chapter 20. A Flight. Rosa no sooner came to herself than the whole of the late interview was before her. It even seemed as if it had pursued her into her insensibility, and she had not a moment's unconsciousness of it. What to do, she was at a frightened loss to know. The only one clear thought in her mind was that she must fly from this terrible man. But where could she take refuge, and how could she go? She had never breathed her dread of him to any one but Helena. If she went to Helena and told her what had passed, that very act might bring down the irreparable mischief that he threatened he had the power, and that she knew he had the will, to do. The more fearful he appeared to her excited memory and imagination, the more alarming her responsibility appeared, seeing that a slight mistake on her part might let his malevolence loose on Helena's brother. Rosa's mind throughout the last 6 months had been stormily confused. A half-formed, wholly unexpressed suspicion tossed in it, now heaving itself up and now sinking into the deep, now gaining palpability and now losing it. Jasper's self-absorption in his nephew when he was alive, and his unceasing pursuit of the inquiry how he came by his death, if he were dead, were themes so rife in the place that no one appeared able to suspect the possibility of foul play at his hands. She had asked herself the question, "Am I so wicked in my thoughts as to conceive a wickedness that others cannot imagine?" Then she had considered, did the suspicion come of her previous recoiling from him before the fact? And if so, was not that a proof of its baselessness? Then she had reflected, what motive could he have, according to my accusation? she was ashamed to answer in her mind.
"The motive of gaining me,"
and covered her face, as if the lightest shadow of the idea of founding murder on such an idle vanity were a crime almost as great. She ran over in her mind again all that he had said by the sundial in the garden. He had persisted in treating the disappearance as murder, consistently with his whole public course since the finding of the watch and shirt-pin. If he were afraid of the crime being traced out, would he not rather encourage the idea of a voluntary disappearance? He had even declared that if the ties between him and his nephew had been less strong, he might have swept even him away from her side. Was that like his having really done so? He had spoken of laying his 6 months' labours in the cause of a just vengeance at her feet. Would he have done that, with that violence of passion, if they were a pretence? Would he have ranged them with his desolate heart and soul, his wasted life, his peace and his despair? The very first sacrifice that he represented himself as making for her was his fidelity to his dear boy after death. Surely these facts were strong against a fancy that scarcely dared to hint itself. And yet he was so terrible a man. In short, the poor girl, for what could she know of the criminal intellect which its own professed students perpetually misread, because they persist in trying to reconcile it with the average intelligence of average men, instead of identifying it as a horrible wonder apart, could get by no road to any other conclusion than that he was a terrible man, and must be fled from. She had been Helena's stay and comfort during the whole time. She had constantly assured her of her full belief in her brother's innocence, and of her sympathy with him in his misery. But she had never seen him since the disappearance, nor had Helena ever spoken one word of his avowal to Mr. Crisparkle in regard of Rosa, though as a part of the interest of the case it was well known far and wide. He was Helena's unfortunate brother to her, and nothing more. The assurance she had given her odious suitor was strictly true, though it would have been better, she considered now, if she could have restrained herself from so giving it. Afraid of him as the bright and delicate little creature was, her spirit swelled at the thought of his knowing it from her own lips. But where was she to go? Anywhere beyond his reach was no reply to the question. Somewhere must be thought of. She determined to go to her guardian, and to go immediately. The feeling she had imparted to Helena on the night of their first confidence was so strong upon her, the feeling of not being safe from him, and of the solid walls of the old convent being powerless to keep out his ghostly following of her, that no reasoning of her own could calm her terrors. The fascination of repulsion had been upon her so long, and now culminated so darkly, that she felt as if he had power to bind her by a spell. Glancing out at window even now as she rose to dress, the sight of the sundial on which he had leaned when he declared himself turned her cold and made her shrink from it, as though he had invested it with some awful quality from his own nature. She wrote a hurried note to Miss Twinkleton, saying that she had sudden reason for wishing to see her guardian promptly, and had gone to him. Also entreating the good lady not to be uneasy, for all was well with her. She hurried a few quite useless articles into a very little bag, left the note in a conspicuous place, and went out, softly closing the gate after her. It was the first time she had ever been even in Cloisterham High Street alone. But knowing all its ways and windings very well, she hurried straight to the corner from which the omnibus departed. It was at that very moment going off.
Stop and take me, if you please, Joe. I am obliged to go to London."
In less than another minute she was on her road to the railway, under Joe's protection. Joe waited on her when she got there, put her safely into the railway carriage, and handed in the very little bag after her, as though it were some enormous trunk, hundredweights heavy, which she must on no account endeavour to lift.
"Can you go round when you get back, and tell Miss Twinkleton that you saw me safely off, Joe?"
"It shall be done, miss."
"With my love, please, Joe."
"Yes, miss, and I wouldn't mind having it myself."
But Joe did not articulate the last clause, only thought it. Now that she was whirling away from London in real earnest, Rosa was at leisure to resume the thoughts which her personal hurry had checked. The indignant thought that his declaration of love soiled her, that she could only be cleansed from the stain of its impurity by appealing to the honest and true, supported her for a time against her fears, and confirmed her in her hasty resolution. But as the evening grew darker and darker, and the great city impended nearer and nearer, the doubts usual in such cases began to arise. Whether this was not a wild proceeding after all, how Mr. Grewgious would regard it, whether she should find him at the journey's end, how she would act if he were absent, what might become of her alone in a place so strange and crowded, how if she had but waited and taken counsel first, whether, if she could now go back, she would not do it thankfully. A multitude of such uneasy speculations disturbed her more and more as they accumulated. At length the train came into London over the housetops, and down below lay the gritty streets with their yet unneeded lamps aglow on a hot, light summer's night. Hiram Grewgious, Esquire, Staple Inn, London. This was all Rosa knew of her destination, but it was enough to send her rattling away again in a cab, through deserts of gritty streets where many people crowded at the corner of courts and byways to get some air, and where many other people walked with a miserable monotonous noise of shuffling of feet on hot paving-stones, and where all the people and all their surroundings were so gritty and so shabby. There was music playing here and there, but it did not enliven the case. No barrel organ mended the matter, and no big drum beat dull care away. Like the chapel bells that were also going here and there, they only seemed to evoke echoes from brick surfaces and dust from everything. As to the flat wind instruments, they seemed to have cracked their hearts and souls in pining for the country. Her jingling conveyance stopped at last at a fast-closed gateway, which appeared to belong to somebody who had gone to bed very early, and was much afraid of housebreakers. Rosa, discharging her conveyance, timidly knocked at this gateway and was let in, very little bag and all, by a watchman.
"Does Mr. Grewgious live here?"
"Mr. Grewgious lives there, miss," said the watchman, pointing further in.
So Rosa went further in, and when the clocks were striking 10, stood on P.J.T.'s doorsteps, wondering what P.J.T. had done with his street door. Guided by the painted name of Mr. Grewgious, she went upstairs and softly tapped and tapped several times. But no one answering, and Mr. Grewgious's door-handle yielding to her touch, she went in and saw her guardian sitting on a window-seat at an open window, with a shaded lamp placed far from him on a table in the corner. Rosa drew nearer to him in the twilight of the room. He saw her, and he said in an undertone, "Good heaven!" Rosa fell upon his neck with tears, and then he said, returning her embrace,
"My child, my child! I thought you were your mother. But what," he added soothingly, has happened? My dear, what has brought you here? Who has brought you here?"
"No one. I came alone."
"Lord bless me!" ejaculated Mr. Grewgious. "Came alone? Why didn't you write to me to come and fetch you?"
"I had no time. I took a sudden resolution. Poor, poor Eddy!"
"Ah, poor fellow, poor fellow!"
"His uncle has made love to me. I cannot bear it,"
said Rosa, at once with a burst of tears and a stamp of her little foot.
"I shudder with horror of him, and I have come to you to protect me and all of us from him, if you will."
"I will,"
cried Mr. Grewgious, with a sudden rush of amazing energy. "Damn him! Confound his politics! Frustrate his knavish tricks! On thee his hopes to fix! Damn him again!" After this most extraordinary outburst, Mr. Grewgious, quite beside himself, plunged about the room, to all appearance undecided whether he was in a fit of loyal enthusiasm or combative denunciation. He stopped and said, wiping his face,
"I beg your pardon, my dear, but you will be glad to know I feel better. Tell me no more just now, or I might do it again. You must be refreshed and cheered. What did you take last? Was it breakfast, lunch, dinner, tea, or supper? And what will you take next? Shall it be breakfast, lunch, dinner, tea, or supper?"
The respectful tenderness with which, on one knee before her, he helped her to remove her hat and disentangle her pretty hair from it, was quite a chivalrous sight. Yet who, knowing him only on the surface, would have expected chivalry, and of the true sort too, not the spurious, from Mr. Grewgious?
"Your rest too must be provided for," he went on, "and you shall have the prettiest chamber in Furnival's. Your toilet must be provided for, and you shall have everything that an unlimited head chambermaid, by which expression I mean a head chambermaid not limited as to outlay, can procure. Is that a bag?"
He looked hard at it. Sooth to say, it required hard looking at to be seen at all in a dimly lighted room.
"And is it your property, my dear?"
"Yes, sir, I brought it with me."
"It is not an extensive bag," said Mr. Grewgious candidly, "though admirably calculated to contain a day's provision for a canary bird. Perhaps you brought a canary bird?"
Rosa smiled and shook her head.
"If you had, he should have been made welcome," said Mr. Grewgious, "and I think he would have been pleased to be hung upon a nail outside, and pit himself against our staple sparrows, whose execution must be admitted to be not quite equal to their intention, which is the case with so many of us. You didn't say what meal, my dear. Have a nice jumble of all meals."
Rosa thanked him, but said she could only take a cup of tea. Mr. Grewgious, after several times running out and in again to mention such supplementary items as marmalade, eggs, watercresses, salted fish, and frizzled ham, ran across to Furnival's without his hat to give his various directions. And soon afterward they were realized in practice, and the board was spread.
"Lord bless my soul!" cried Mr. Grewgious, putting a lamp upon it and taking his seat opposite Rosa. "What a new sensation for a poor old angular bachelor, to be sure!"
Rosa's expressive little eyebrows asked him what he meant.
"The sensation of having a sweet young presence in the place, that whitewashes it, paints it, papers it, decorates it with gilding, and makes it glorious," said Mr. Grewgious. "Ah me, ah me!"
As there was something mournful in his sigh, Rosa, in touching him with her teacup, ventured to touch him with her small hand too.
"Thank you, my dear," said Mr. Grewgious.
Let's talk. Do you always live here, sir? Asked Rosa.
Yes, my dear.
And always alone?
Always alone, except that I have daily company in a gentleman by the name of Bazzard, my clerk.
He doesn't live here?
No, he goes his way after office hours. In fact, he is off duty here altogether just at present, and a firm downstairs with which I have business relations lent me a substitute. But it would be extremely difficult to replace Mr. Bazzard.
He must be very fond of you, said Rosa.
He bears up against it with commendable fortitude if he is, returned Mr. Grewgious, after considering the matter. But I doubt if he is. Not particularly so. You see, he is discontented, poor fellow.
Why isn't he contented? Was the natural inquiry.
Misplaced, said Mr. Grewgious with great mystery.
Rosa's eyebrows resumed their inquisitive and perplexed expression.
So misplaced, Mr. Grewgious went on, that I feel constantly apologetic towards him, and he feels, though he doesn't mention it, that I have reason to be.
Mr. Grewgious had by this time grown so very mysterious that Rosa did not know how to go on. While she was thinking about it, Mr. Grewgious suddenly jerked out of himself for the second time.
"Let's talk. We were speaking of Mr. Bazzard. It's a secret, and moreover it is Mr. Bazzard's secret. But the sweet presence at my table makes me so unusually expansive that I feel I must impart it in inviolable confidence. What do you think Mr. Bazzard has done?"
"Oh, dear!" cried Rosa, drawing her chair a little nearer, and her mind reverting to Jasper. "Nothing dreadful, I hope?"
"He has written a play," said Mr. Grewgious in a solemn whisper. "A tragedy."
Rosa seemed much relieved.
"And nobody," pursued Mr. Grewgious in the same tone, "will hear on any account whatever of bringing it out."
Rosa looked reflective, and nodded her head slowly, as who should say, "Such things are, and why are they?"
"Now you know," said Mr. Grewgious, "I couldn't write a play."
"Not a bad one, sir?" said Rosa, innocently, with her eyebrows again in action.
"No, if I was under sentence of decapitation and was about to be instantly decapitated, and an express arrived with a pardon for the condemned convict Grewgious, if he wrote a play, I should be under the necessity of resuming the block and begging the executioner to proceed to extremities."
"Meaning?"
said Mr. Grewgious, passing his hand under his chin.
"The singular number. And this extremity."
Rosa appeared to consider what she would do if the awkward, suppositious case were hers.
"Consequently," said Mr. Grewgious, "Mr. Bazzard would have a sense of my inferiority to himself under any circumstances. But when I am his master, you know, the case is greatly aggravated."
Mr. Grewgious shook his head seriously, as if he felt the offence to be a little too much, though of his own committing. "How came you to be his master, sir?" asked Rosa.
"A question that naturally follows," said Mr. Grewgious. "Let's talk. Mr. Bazzard's father, being a Norfolk farmer, would have furiously laid about him with a flail, a pitchfork, and every agricultural implement available for assaulting purposes, on the slightest hint of his son's having written a play. So the son bringing to me the father's rent, which I receive, imparted his secret, and pointed out that he was determined to pursue his genius, and that it would put him in peril of starvation,
and that he was not formed for it. For pursuing his genius, sir?
No, my dear, said Mr. Grewgious, for starvation. It was impossible to deny the position that Mr. Bazzard was not formed to be starved, and Mr. Bazzard then pointed out that it was desirable that I should stand between him and a fate so perfectly unsuited to his formation. In that way Mr. Bazzard became my clerk, and he feels it very much.
"I am glad he is grateful," said Rosa.
"I didn't quite mean that, my dear. I mean that he feels the degradation. There are some other geniuses that Mr. Bazzard has become acquainted with, who have also written tragedies which, likewise, nobody will on any account whatever hear of bringing out. And these choice spirits dedicate their plays to one another in a highly panegyrical manner. Mr. Bazzard has been the subject of one of these dedications. Now, you know, I never had a play dedicated to me."
Rosa looked at him as if she would have liked him to be the recipient of a thousand dedications,
which again, naturally, rubs against the grain of Mr. Bazzard, said Mr. Grewgious. "He is very short with me sometimes, and then I feel that he is meditating. This blockhead is my master, a fellow who couldn't write a tragedy on pain of death, and who will never have one dedicated to him with the most complimentary congratulations on the high position he has taken in the eyes of posterity. Very trying, very trying. However, in giving him directions, I reflect beforehand. Perhaps he may not like this, or he might take it ill if I asked that. And so we get on very well. Indeed, better than I could have expected."
"Is the tragedy named, sir?" asked Rosa.
"Strictly between ourselves," answered Mr. Grewgious, "it has a dreadfully appropriate name. It is called The Thorn of Anxiety. But Mr. Bazzard hopes, and I hope, that it will come out at last."
It was not hard to divine that Mr. Grewgious had related the Bazzard history thus fully, at least quite as much for the recreation of his ward's mind from the subject that had driven her there, as for the gratification of his own tendency to be social and communicative.
"And now, my dear," he said at this point, "if you are not too tired to tell me more of what passed to-day, but only if you feel quite able, I should be glad to hear it. I may digest it the better if I sleep on it to-night."
Rosa, composed now, gave him a faithful account of the interview. Mr. Grewgious often smoothed his head while it was in progress, and begged to be told a second time those parts which bore on Helena and Neville. When Rosa had finished, he sat grave, silent, and meditative for a while.
"Clearly narrated," was his only remark at last, "and I hope clearly put away here," smoothing his head again. "See, my dear," taking her to the open window, "where they live, the dark windows over yonder."
"May I go to Helena to-morrow?" asked Rosa.
"I should like to sleep on that question to-night," he answered doubtfully. "But let me take you to your own rest, for you must need it."
With that, Mr. Grewgious helped her to get her hat on again, and hung upon his arm the very little bag that was of no earthly use, and led her by the hand, with a certain stately awkwardness, as if he were going to walk a minuet, across Holborn and into Furnival's Inn. At the hotel door he confided her to the unlimited head chambermaid, and said that while she went up to see her room, he would remain below, in case she should wish it exchanged for another, or should find that there was anything she wanted. Rosa's room was airy, clean, comfortable, almost gay. The Unlimited had laid in everything omitted from the very little bag, that is to say, everything she could possibly need, and Rosa tripped down the great many stairs again to thank her guardian for his thoughtful and affectionate care of her.
"Not at all, my dear," said Mr. Grewgious, infinitely gratified. "It is I who thank you for your charming confidence and for your charming company. Your breakfast will be provided for you in a neat, compact, and graceful little sitting-room appropriate to your figure, and I will come to you at 10 o'clock in the morning. I hope you don't feel very strange indeed in this strange place."
"Oh, no, I feel so safe."
"Yes, you may be sure that the stairs are fireproof," said Mr. Grewgious, "and that any outbreak of the devouring element would be perceived and suppressed by the watchman."
"I did not mean that," Rosa replied. "I mean, I feel so safe from him."
"There is a stout gate of iron bars to keep him out," said Mr. Grewgious, smiling, "and Furnival's is fireproof, and specially watched and lighted, and I live over the way."
In the stoutness of his knight-errantry, he seemed to think the last-named protection all-sufficient. In the same spirit, he said to the gate-porter as he went out,
"If someone staying in the hotel should wish to send across the road to me in the night, a crown will be ready for the messenger."
In the same spirit, he walked up and down outside the iron gate for the best part of an hour with some solicitude, occasionally looking in between the bars, as if he had laid a dove in a high roost in a cage of lions, and had it on his mind that she might tumble out.
End of chapter 20. Read by Alan Chant of Tunbridge in Kent, England, during the summer of 2008. Just 3 chapters remain of this unfinished novel by Charles Dickens.
Chapter 21 of The Mystery of Edwin Drood. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alan Chant. The Mystery of Edwin Drood. The Unfinished Novel by Charles Dickens. Chapter 21. A Recognition. Nothing occurred in the night to flutter the tired dove, and the dove arose refreshed. With Mr. Grewgious, when the clock struck 10 in the morning, came Mr. Crisparkle, who had come at one plunge out of the river at Cloisterham.
"Miss Twinkleton was so uneasy, Miss Rosa," he explained to her, "and came round to Ma and me with your note, in such a state of wonder, that, to quiet her, I volunteered on this service by the very first train to be caught in the morning. I wished at the time that you had come to me, but now I think it best that you did as you did, and came to your guardian."
"I did think of you," Rosa told him, "but Minor Canon Corner was so near him."
"I understand. It is quite natural."
"I have told Mr. Crisparkle," said Mr. Grewgious, "all that you told me last night, my dear. Of course, I should have written it to him immediately, but his coming was most opportune. And it was particularly kind of him to come, for he had but just gone."
"Have you settled," asked Rosa, appealing to them both, "what is to be done for Helena and her brother?"
"Why, really," said Mr. Crisparkle, "I am in great perplexity. If even Mr. Grewgious, whose head is much longer than mine, and who is a whole night's cogitation in advance of me, is undecided, what must I be?"
The Unlimited here put her head in at the door, after having rapped, and been authorised to present herself, announcing that a gentleman wished for a word with another gentleman named Crisparkle, if any such gentleman were there. If no such gentleman were there, he begged pardon for being mistaken.
"Such a gentleman is here," said Mr. Crisparkle, "but is engaged just now." "Is it a dark gentleman?" interposed Rosa, retreating on her guardian.
"No, miss, more of a brown gentleman."
"Are you sure not with black hair?"
asked Rosa, taking courage.
"Quite sure of that, miss. Brown hair and blue eyes."
"Perhaps," hinted Mr. Grewgious, with habitual caution, "it might be well to see him, reverend sir, if you don't object. When one is in a difficulty or a loss, one never knows in what direction a way out may chance to open. It is a business principle of mine, in such a case, not to close up any direction, but to keep an eye on every direction that may present itself. I could relate an anecdote in point, but that it would be premature."
"If Miss Rosa will allow me, then, let the gentleman come in," said Mr. Crisparkle.
The gentleman came in, apologised with a frank but modest grace for not finding Mr. Crisparkle alone, turned to Mr. Crisparkle, and smilingly asked the unexpected question.
"Who am I?"
"You are the gentleman I saw smoking under the trees in Staple Inn a few minutes ago."
"True, I saw you there. Who else am I?"
Mr. Crisparkle concentrated his attention on a handsome face, much sunburnt, and the ghost of some departed boy seemed to rise gradually and dimly in the room. The gentleman saw a struggling recollection lighten up the Minor Canon's features, and smiling again, said,
"What will you have for breakfast this morning? You are out of jam."
"Wait a moment," cried Mr. Crisparkle, raising his right hand. "Give me another instant. Tartar!"
The two shook hands with the greatest heartiness, and then went the wonderful length, for Englishmen, of laying their hands each on the other's shoulders and looking joyfully each into the other's face.
"My old fag," said Mr. Crisparkle.
"My old master," said Mr. Tartar.
"You saved me from drowning," said Mr. Crisparkle.
"After which you took to swimming, you know," said Mr. Tartar.
"God bless my soul," said Mr. Crisparkle.
"Amen,"
said Mr. Tartar, and then they fell to shaking hands most heartily again.
"Imagine," exclaimed Mr. Crisparkle with glistening eyes, "Miss Rosa Budd and Mr. Grewgious, imagine Mr. Tartar, when he was the smallest of juniors, diving for me, catching me, a big, heavy senior, by the hair of the head, and striking out for the shore with me like a water giant.
Imagine my not letting him sink, as I was his fag," said Mr. Tartar. "But the truth being that he was my best protector and friend, and did me more good than all the masters put together, an irrational impulse seized me to pick him up or go down with him."
Permit me, sir, to have the honour," said Mr. Grewgious, advancing with extended hand, "for an honour I truly esteem it. I am proud to make your acquaintance. I hope you didn't take cold. I hope you were not inconvenienced by swallowing too much water. How have you been since?"
It was by no means apparent that Mr. Grewgious knew what he said, though it was very apparent that he meant to say something highly friendly and appreciative. If heaven, Rosa thought, had but sent such courage and skill to her poor mother's aid, and he to have been so slight and young then.
"I don't wish to be complimented upon it, I thank you, but I think I have an idea," Mr. Grewgious announced,
after taking a jog-trot or two across the room, so unexpected and unaccountable that they all stared at him, doubtful whether he was choking or had the cramp.
"I think I have an idea. I believe I have had the pleasure of seeing Mr. Tartar's name as tenant of the top set in the house, next to the top set in the corner."
"Yes, sir," returned Mr. Tartar, "you are right so far.
"I am right so far," said Mr. Grewgious. "Tick that off," which he did, with his right thumb on his left. "Might you happen to know the name of your neighbour in the top set on the other side of the party wall?" Coming very close to Mr. Tartar, to lose nothing of his face in his shortness of sight.
"Landless."
"Tick that off," said Mr. Grewgious, taking another trot, and then coming back.
"No personal knowledge, I suppose, sir?"
"Slight, but some."
"Tick that off,"
said Mr. Grewgious, taking another trot, and again coming back.
"Nature of knowledge, Mr. Tartar?"
"I thought he seemed to be a young fellow in a poor way, and I asked his leave, only within a day or so, to share my flowers up there with him, that is to say, to extend my flower garden to his windows."
"Would you have the kindness to take seats?" said Mr. Grewgious. "I have an idea."
They complied, Mr. Tartar none the less readily for being all abroad, and Mr. Grewgious, seated in the corner with his hands upon his knees, thus stated his idea, with his usual manner of having got the statement by heart.
"I cannot as yet make up my mind whether it is prudent to hold open communication under present circumstances, and on the part of the fair member of the present company, with Mr. Neville or Miss Helena. I have reason to know that a local friend of ours, on whom I beg to bestow a passing
but a
hearty malediction, with the kind permission of my reverend friend, sneaks to and fro and dodges up and down. When not doing so himself, he may have some informant skulking about, in the person of a watchman, porter, or such-like hanger-on of stable. On the other hand, Miss Rosa very naturally wishes to see her friend Miss Helena, and it would seem important that at least Miss Helena, if not her brother too through her, should privately know from Miss Rosa's lips what has occurred and what has been threatened. Am I agreed with generally in the views I take?"
"I entirely coincide with them," said Mr. Crisparkle, who had been very attentive.
"As I have no doubt I should," added Mr. Tartar, smiling, "if I understood them."
"Fair and softly, sir," said Mr. Grewgious. "We shall fully confide in you directly, if you will favour us with your permission. Now, if our local friend should have any informant on the spot, it is tolerably clear that such informant can only be set to watch the chambers in the occupation of Mr. Neville, he reporting to our local friend who comes and goes there. Our local friend would supply for himself, from his own previous knowledge, the identity of the parties. Nobody can be set to watch all stable, or to concern himself with comers and goers to other sets of chambers, unless indeed mine."
"I begin to understand what you tend," said Mr. Crisparkle, "and highly approve of your caution."
"I needn't repeat that I know nothing yet of the why and wherefore," said Mr. Tartar, "but I also understand to what you tend, so let me say at once that my chambers are freely at your disposal."
"There," cried Mr. Grewgious, smoothing his head triumphantly, "now we have all got the idea. You have it, my dear?"
"I think I have," said Rosa, blushing a little as Mr. Tartar looked quickly towards her.
"You see, you go over to Staple with Mr. Crisparkle and Mr. Tartar," said Mr. Grewgious. "I going in and out and out and in alone, in my usual way. You go up with those gentlemen to Mr. Tartar's rooms. You look into Mr. Tartar's flower garden. You wait for Miss Helena's appearance there, or you signify to Miss Helena that you are close by, and you communicate with her freely, and no spy can be the wiser."
I am very much afraid I shall be—"
"Be what, my dear?" asked Mr. Grewgious, as she hesitated. "Not frightened?"
"No, not that," said Rosa, shyly. "In Mr. Tartar's way. We seem to be appropriating Mr. Tartar's residence so very coolly."
"I protest to you," returned that gentleman, "that I shall think the better of it for evermore, if your voice sounds in it only once."
Rosa, not quite knowing what to say about that, cast down her eyes, and, turning to Mr. Grewgious, dutifully asked if she could put her hat on. Mr. Grewgious being of opinion that she could do no better, she withdrew for the purpose. Mr. Crisparkle took the opportunity of giving Mr. Tartar a summary of the distresses of Neville and his sister. The opportunity was quite long enough, as the hat happened to require a little extra fitting on. Mr. Tartar gave his arm to Rosa, and Mr. Crisparkle walked detached in front.
"Poor, poor Eddy,"
thought Rosa as they went along. Mr. Tartar waved his right hand as he bent his head down over Rosa, talking in an animated way.
"It was not so powerful or so sunbrowned when it saved Mr. Crisparkle,"
thought Rosa, glancing at it,
"but it must have been very steady and determined even then."
Mr. Tartar told her that he had been a sailor, roving everywhere, for years and years.
"When are you going to sea again?" asked Rosa.
"Never."
Rosa wondered what the girls would say if they could see her crossing the wide street on the sailor's arm, and she fancied that the passers-by must think her very little and very helpless, contrasted with the strong figure that could have caught her up and carried her out of any danger, miles and miles without resting. She was thinking further that his far-seeing blue eyes looked as if they had been used to watch dangers afar off, and to watch it without flinching, drawing nearer and nearer, when, happening to raise her own eyes, she found that he seemed to be thinking something about them. This a little confused Rosebud, and may account for her never afterwards quite knowing how she ascended, with his help, to his garden in the air, and seemed to get into a marvellous country that came into sudden bloom like the country on the summit of the magic beanstalk. May it flourish for ever. End of Chapter 21. Read by Alan Chant of Tunbridge in Kent, England, during the summer of 2008. Two chapters remain in this unfinished novel by Charles Dickens.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.